If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Right, OK, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening once again to Life on Planet Porky. I am Mike Porky Parry, and I'm delighted that I have with me again today Leslie-Ann Jones. Leslie-Ann, thank you very much indeed for coming into these studios today to join me for this latest podcast. And also delighted with the response we got to our rant on wine in our last podcast. I mean, we feel quite strongly about these things, don't we?
Well, we do, and people are feeling strongly as well, you know? So we're getting responses from both sides,
yes,
which is always good for an argument.
A lot of shock about that you admitted to drinking 3 bottles of wine a day in your heyday.
Well, I was young.
How can you still look so good when you've been poisoning your body like
Bless
that?
Bless you. I had to give it up because I was pregnant. We all know we shouldn't drink alcohol.
Right.
When
yeah.
we're expecting a baby.
Well, of course not, no.
So the first one, so I was only in my 20s. I had
yes.
to give it up, and
yep.
then I never regained that capacity that I'd had in the first
Did
place.
You regain the taste?
Yeah, but yeah, by default, you have to, mm. yeah,
something,
you've got to keep it down.
I mean, something's definitely happened to me over the years because, you know, at one time, and I really miss this, at one time, if I had, say, a Sunday afternoon on my own, and you don't often have Sunday afternoons on your own, do you? You're out or you party or something like that. But sometimes I would just feel good about something. I would put on every Beatle record I could remember. I would just keep pouring wine from the fridge until it ran out. But it never ran out in those days, you know, when we were in our 30s or something like that. It never ran out. I would open the back door onto the roof garden, you know, and I would even, I confess, have a couple of cigarettes because I felt that good, you know what I mean? And because I smoked so rarely, when I had a cigarette, it was like somebody else smoking cannabis, you know, and completely lightheaded, you know, spinning around and all that. But it was kind of a good feeling. But the point I'm making is there was no physical restriction on how much I would drink on a Sunday
Did
on
you
my
get
own.
Hangover?
No, I never got hangovers in those days. Yeah. And so, unusually speaking, I'd be up at 6 o'clock. Excuse me, on Monday, because normally I was doing something responsible, like I was the news editor of a paper or I was the program director of a radio station or something like that, and had to be with it. But after my heart went in, that was 2004/5, I never got the capacity back again. In fact, some would say, well, perhaps your heart went because of the enormous capacity you had before, but it didn't. It went because I had a disease inherited from my father called dilated cardiomyopathy, and alcohol triggered it. It didn't cause it. I don't drink anything like as much as some of my colleagues have drunk over the years. It was just occasionally that would happen. But nevertheless...
So what I've never done is drink by myself. And when I got divorced,
yes.
I decided that was a really slippery slope.
Right.
To sit indoors
yes.
and drink myself stupid
yes.
and feel sorry for myself.
Not even if you're watching something on television,
no,
which interested
no,
you. Because I'll have a few glasses if I'm watching a football
no,
match.
No, I don't do it. Not by myself.
No.
Because there's no yardstick. There's no
yeah.
other person there
yeah.
to
yeah.
say, actually, you've had enough. Or
yes.
maybe you don't want that 18th
yes.
glass or whatever it is.
Yes.
So, no, I never drink by
yeah.
myself.
Well, it's a very rare occasion for me because normally speaking, I'd be with the family on a Sunday afternoon, roast beef and all that. But like they'd go on holiday or something like that, you know what I mean? I wouldn't bother inviting a mate round because friends can be a nuisance on a Sunday afternoon. They get too pissed. How do you get them home? And all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? But anyway, look, that was just an observation from the listeners' observations about your, you know, enormous wine intake in your glory days. Although you're still in your glory days, Leslie-Ann, so I wouldn't worry about that.
It was
okay?
all on expenses, guys.
Yeah, well, of course, it was actually. Yeah, it was a great thing, wasn't it? Like a second salary.
Yeah.
Now, look, I want to tell you, I want to talk to you about a piece that you and I have discussed off air, but I'm absolutely fascinated about this, right? And this is a colleague called Claudia Cannell. Now, I don't really know Claudia, but I've known of her for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. And she's always been a female writer, a woman's writer. You know, I'm not saying that she's not capable of writing, you know, stuff on politics and all that. She has done, I'm sure. But she's written this amazing piece, which we've got to try and get to the bottom of, because you're very cynical about it, but I think there's something in it. She moves to a new house, right, and she suddenly finds very strange things happening. And the main one that made her really question her own sanity and led her to believe something very strange was going on is that she walked into her kitchen one day to find a paintbrush coated in dried red paint on the kitchen table that did not belong to her, was not hers, and had not been there when she left the house that morning to go to work. She came back after she'd been experiencing what she thought was strange episodes in the house, and this finally convinced her that something terribly weird was happening. Prior to that, she'd only thought things had gone funny, but decided it might be her memory. On one occasion, when she came home, she was working in the kitchen and she took her earrings off and she put them in an egg cup, and the egg cup was on a shelf in front of her. And 2 or 3 hours later, when she'd finished and washed up, she went back to get her earrings. They weren't there. She never saw the earrings again. They disappeared.
Now, this is somebody who drinks 18 glasses of wine on their own in their house.
Now, do you know that for sure? Or are you accusing Claudia of this?
No, I'm surmising.
Right.
Look, she's moved to Brighton.
Yes.
This could be the neighbours ganging up on her. Oh, we don't like a Daily Mail journalist in our midst. You know, let's start terrorising
her. Break into her house and steal her earrings?
She's claiming a collision of negative vortexes.
Yep.
I would have written vortices, but anyway. And that it all stems from geopathic stress.
Yes.
And she's got this expert in to come and cleanse her
house.
This
is a woman called Emma Loveheart, right?
She's seen Claudia coming.
Who has a website. Claudia says when she met her, she looked reassuringly normal. She didn't have home-dyed pink hair, and there were no pictures of ghosts in nightcaps carrying candles in her office. When we met, I discovered that Emma, 51, from Newbury in Berkshire, hadn't even considered herself to be spiritual until 8 years ago, when she suddenly found she was picking up messages. But she doesn't believe that it's ghosts. She believes it's some kind of spiritual force that does these things.
Now, what do you think?
Well, I think there must be something in it. Look, Claudia Cannell's not a nutter, that's for sure, because she's held down a job in Fleet Street for 2 or 3 decades, OK? I know there's a general perception in certain areas of society that journalists make things up. I don't think we do. Most everything I've ever read in the newspaper has had a basis in fact. Certainly, there have been areas where facts have been built upon. Certainly, there have been areas where there've been economies with the truth, but there's always been a germ of fact there
so
for me.
So I'm not saying that she's made this up.
Yep.
I'm saying that she is observing things that are happening in her home,
yep,
that have disturbed her, and that she's, yep, gone looking for help, and that this woman has seen her coming. Because there's a lot of charlatans, kind of psychic people out there.
Yeah, but Claudia doesn't complain about paying her thousands of pounds or anything like that. She says she paid her a set fee that she charges to everybody
she
consults.
This,
120 quid, I think it was.
This is how she makes her living.
Yeah.
Now, is there any guarantee that what this lady has done in her house has sent the spooks away?
Well, I don't think it is. I think what Claudia's come to realise is she might have to live with it. So what she says is, she says that this woman, this expert, Emma, detected 7 negative energy blocks. These are areas of the house that hold onto negative energy and create the bad atmosphere that Claudia says she was constantly feeling. The only good news was that the geopathic stress in the house and the electromagnetic waves in the earth was about average. When Emma gathered all her psychic readings from inside the house, she gave it a vitality rating. This is a way, you see, you're laughing. This is a way of measuring positive life force within a property. Anything less than 100% means energy is being drained in some way. Mine was zero. All normal human energy had been drawn out the house, and Claudia says zero is rock bottom. And I was left all the time feeling strange in my own house.
This is cutting edge science, Michael.
Well, I think there's something in it.
Where's the scientist that's come around and proven the credentials of this woman?
I think it's beyond science.
Really?
I think it is psychic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you had a ghostly experience?
No, never.
Okay, so you base your belief on what?
Well, I base my belief on two things. Claudia's not an idiot because she's worked for a very respectable newspaper, the Daily Mail, for 2 or 3 years. Daily Mail has a reputation to protect. Some people don't like its politics, but it is a fine example of journalism. They very rarely get pulled up for fabrications or anything that's gone wrong.
I'm not saying she's fabricated.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I'm suspicious of this woman.
Right. Which woman? Claudia Kinnell or the
consultant that she's brought in to try and cure the problem, okay?
Yeah.
There's no scientific basis to what she is trading on, to what she's selling.
Yeah.
So Claudia is paying her 120 quid, whatever, to come and do what exactly? She could tell her anything.
Yeah. Well, where did the paintbrush come from then?
It could have been the woman next door or the guy down the road painting a fence.
That means somebody must have broken into a house.
Or somebody's dog has wandered in the cat flap with it or something.
No, it can't be that.
Sorry to sound cynical, but I haven't had any kind of paranormal experience in my life.
Neither have I.
And I tend to think that these things are overinflated, exaggerated, and a bit of a drama.
Well,
it made a great spread in the Daily Mail, didn't it? And Claudia got paid a nice fat freelance fee for this.
Well, that's what she's there for, to write interesting material.
Of course it is. I just don't buy it. Don't buy it.
Well, you know, I think you're too much of a cynic.
Do you believe in ley lines?
Ley lines. Is that all to do with Feng Shui?
No.
Feng Shui?
It's ancient kind of lines of energy that run under the earth, supposedly. Stonehenge is meant to be a cluster of
ley
lines.
But isn't that why people turn the couch towards one particular direction in their house and all that?
That's Feng Shui.
That's Feng Shui.
Yeah. Okay. That is a different thing.
Okay, well, I think there's something
to do with luck, isn't it?
Dealing with luck.
Well, I'd love to see some proof.
Well,
I'd love this lady to come along and prove this to me.
I don't think you can prove it. Now, listen, do you know who Peter Fonda is?
Oh, yeah.
He's just died, okay?
I know. God rest him.
Now, do you remember Easy Rider? Did Easy Rider have the same effect on teenage girls as it had on teenage boys?
No. No, it was a very macho movie, wasn't it?
It was very macho. And to teenage boys, because I was about 13 at the time, I think, it came out, something like that. I mean, me and my mate went to see it after seeing the poster outside the cinema, you know. I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great to ride a great big motorbike like Captain America? And Dennis Hopper, you know, is the guy over the road with it. And it was so glamorous and so sort of up there with, you know, like in America, the feeling of the free road.
The open road.
The open road. Mm-hmm. Get on the road. Get on your, you know.
On your bike.
it's the Steppenwolf song, you know. Bike. Get your motor running. Da, da, da. And get out on the highway. Looking for adventure. In whatever comes my way. Oh, baby, gonna, you know, and all that kind of stuff. We all wanted to do that.
Yeah, it was an ideal.
We wanted to feel the wind running through our hair as we're burning down Route 66.
And also, it was very cool. Anything American.
Yes.
Anything of American culture at that time was really,
it was
really
funny,
cool.
Funny enough, what had only just come to Britain were American football shirts with big numbers on
them.
There you go. Because English football shirts, you know, were much smaller, didn't have numbers on them.
Nancy, weren't they?
Nancy. Mm-hmm. And the American football shirts had come and bumpers had started arriving in this country, you know.
Pull up to the bumper, baby.
That's right. All that kind of stuff. But anyway, Peter Fonda has died. I think he was about 96 or something.
79, wasn't he?
79, yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, it would be 79. And I think his father would have been 96 if he was alive. No, that doesn't make sense.
Oh, he's done.
Isn't Henry
Jane
Fonda
left now?
So Jane Fonda's left. She was known as Hanoi Jane.
Hanoi Jane.
Because she sat in the aircraft, an anti-aircraft gun seat for the Viet Cong, believe it or not.
I mean, but in Barbarella, famously had an orgasm through the palm of her hand.
That's
Do you remember
right.
that?
Didn't they take pills?
That makes
as
your
well?
Hair stand on end, doesn't
it? It makes your hair stand on end, but also, didn't they have sex by just taking a pill?
Oh, it makes sex so quick and easy. Who wants sex to be quick and easy?
Absolutely.
Guys?
And didn't they shout down from the clouds, Barbarella? Because she dressed in that, you know, very sexy sort of outfit and all that.
Bet she never had her ley lines red.
No, I bet she never had her ley lines red, no. But anyway, the point of the story is, right, that this was Peter Fonda taking on the establishment in the early 70s when Vietnam was going on. What I didn't realise was he became an outcast in Hollywood because the establishment said, you're trying to turn the country against us. You're trying to turn the youth of America against us in much the same way as John Lennon was. And he was literally ostracised and booted out of the film industry for decades afterwards, you know?
Didn't really make anything of note after that, did he?
I don't think he made anything of note before or after. Easy Rider made, I'm reading from his account of his life, Easy Rider made Fonda a countercultural icon excuse me, his image emblazoned on teenage bedroom walls and university campuses alongside Bob Dylan and Che Guevara and the like. The film also enjoyed critical success, winning a standing ovation at Cannes. You've been to the Cannes Film Festival?
Loads of times, haven't you? Yeah.
And the festival's best first ever work. But he did become iconic. He met the Beatles and he took LSD with the Beatles and eventually met Bob Dylan, who co-wrote the title song, The Ballad of Easy Rider, with Roger McGuinn of the Byrds. Does that make sense?
Roger McGuinn, yeah.
Yeah, and Bob Dylan wrote this after he met him and he'd given him the film plan, but Bob Dylan hated the film so much he never watched it.
How did he hate it? He never watched it.
I don't know. It says here, The Ballad of Easy Rider with Roger McGuinn of the Byrds. But Bob Dylan then so disliked the finished movie. Oh, I'm sorry. He did say
it,
that he took his name off the song.
Okay.
Isn't that, a bit tragic, eh?
But another one of those sort of James Dean figures, you know, great sort of, as you say, iconic, dating back to whenever. But a sad figure in the end because his whole career... trashed.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. We've just been discussing Peter Fonda. I tell you what, Leslie, I don't know about you, but at my age, people are just dying too quickly. I don't wish to be maudlin because we're talking about Peter Fonda, but a very, very great colleague of mine called Steve Curry.
Yeah, God rest Steve.
Has died in the last few days.
Nice man.
And I assume would have been an old colleague of your dad's, yeah?
Yeah.
Let's explain. Your dad, Ken Jones, was one of the...
The voice of sport.
The voice of sport, one of the first and, I would say, most outstanding celebrity sports writers. Original writer on Shoot, wasn't he? And Goal,
Thank
Goal
you.
Magazine.
Well, he started actually on the Daily Mirror.
Yeah.
Progressed to the Sunday Mirror, where
yes.
he became the voice of sport.
Yes.
He did the magazine stuff on the side.
Yes, that's
which
right.
Which you could do in those days.
Yes.
I can remember as a child on Cup Final Day, FA Cup Final Day, walking down the Wembley Way with all the crowds.
Do you know I did that in 66 when Everton got there?
Sure. Posters of my dad stuck into the railings all the way along Wembley Way.
Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah.
What year was that? Do you remember?
Oh, God. 70, early 70s.
Yeah, early 70s. Yeah, that's fantastic. What a thing to see.
But went to The Independent in the end at the inception of that paper and did 15 years there until he retired.
Yes, right. Yeah.
Having fallen under a train and lost his arm.
How sad was that?
But carried on writing.
Yeah, exactly.
For another 12 years.
And of course, it wasn't even the biggest sporting star in your family, was he?
No, my Uncle Cliff, who I was only with him the other day, actually, in a party down in Broadstairs.
Cliff Jones.
So my cousin's party, yeah.
A legend, Spurs legend.
So they call Gareth Bale the new Cliff Jones.
Yes.
You know, it's that sort of Spurs
Well,
absolutely. History,
well, Gareth Jones played like... Gareth Bale played like Cliff Jones, certainly in his last days at Tottenham and for most of his time at Real Madrid. But Steve was a terrific guy because in the world of Fleet Street, it's very cutthroat, we all know. And you don't find many people who are ever willing to help you out because to get to Fleet Street, I mean, when I went to Fleet Street and probably when you were there, there were about 50,000 newspaper journalists in this country, and the vast majority of them worked for local newspapers. They worked for weeklies or evenings or regional mornings, OK? There weren't many working in the broadcasting world because there weren't many sort of broadcasters around. But to get through all that and to get to Fleet Street, you'd done very well, and you obviously did very well. You got to Fleet Street very young. And I got there quite young. I first got to Fleet Street, if you can call the Manchester Daily Express Fleet Street, when I was 26. And then I was actually in Fleet Street the following year, 27. But at 29, I was sent to New York as the New York correspondent of the Daily Express.
Hugely successful.
Well, I had a very successful newspaper career. Yes, that's right, yeah. And then by 32, I was the news editor of the Daily Express. That was great. But
so young as well.
Yes, but you didn't often go around asking people for help because you knew it wasn't really forthcoming. Now, the thing was, I was always the youngest wherever I went. I was the youngest when I joined the Express in Manchester. The next oldest guy to me was 40, and there was a cabal of them, right? And what they'd done is they'd kept people like me out for as long as they possibly could in league with the news editor, who was a guy called Stan Blenkinsop, a great guy, a Geordie. And Stan finally resisted and said, I'm not going to appoint another 40-year-old reporter who just happened to be a mate of theirs who'd just come from the Mirror or the Mail, you know, or the Telegraph. He said, we're going to bring some new blood in. So he put an advert in the UK Press Gazette and 350 people applied for this. And I got the job ahead of some mates of mine. Peter Kent and Roger Taverner both applied for the job, right? And they were gutted, you know, when eventually I revealed that I'd got it, you know. But that's how competitive it, excuse me, it was. But when you got there, none of these 40-year-olds wanted to help me at all in any way. And I didn't care. I couldn't care less because all they wanted to do was sit in the office all day and talk about, you know, how many drinks we're going to have at 6 o'clock and what they're going to have for dinner when they got home, you know. And they had no ambition whatsoever to do anything. Steve Curry was completely different. When I got to London, the age difference wasn't so bad. But one of the first jobs I was sent out on was to go and find Bobby Robson, who was then the England manager's son, was playing his first game for England at something like under 19 level. His son was a rugby player and he was playing rugby. And I had to go out to somewhere like, you know, some traditional rugby. I don't think it was Twickenham, but Richmond or somewhere like that. You know what I mean? Harlequins or something like that. Anyways, no sign of light of this boy. And I said, you know, you've got to go out and get him. Don't come back until you have. And I knew, you know, Steve Curry was a great writer and I'd seen everything he'd done. And, you know, I don't think I'd even met him. I'd only been down in London about a month or something, but I knew of him very well. His picture was in the paper all the time. He worked on the Express, the same paper as me. So I rang from a phone box because there were no mobile phones in those days. And I said to the switchboard operator, can I put, is Steve Curry there, please? You know, it was a Friday afternoon as well, I remember. And I was lucky to get him in the office because, of course, they all work Saturdays. And I said, oh, Steve, I said, it's Mike Parry. I said, you don't know me. He said, right. I said, you know, I'm a news reporter. I've come down from Manchester a week ago. I said, look, I've got a bit of a problem. And I explained. He said, right, OK. I said, do you know Bobby Robson? I didn't know that he was, in fact, Bobby Robson's closest friend in Fleet Street and had, you know, knew him intimately and all that kind of stuff. And I explained. He said, all right. He said, where are you now? I said, I'm in this phone box in Richmond. He said, give me the number. So I gave him the number and he said, don't go anywhere. So I did the usual thing that we do on the road, the pressure of keeping people away from a phone, you know what I mean? You know, telling them, no, the phone's not working, wait for the engineer to ring back and all that. You know. Phone rang and it was Bobby Robson's son.
Wow.
And Steve had contacted him via Bobby, you know, or via the family or something like that, explained what I was doing. He came on, he was nice as pie, found out where he was, got a photographer, go around and get the picture, success. But it couldn't possibly have been a success without Steve.
Yeah, you see, but I had a fair amount of experience of people helping me.
Oh, yeah?
So Jack Tinker, who was the theatre critic on the Mail when I was there.
Yeah.
So he used to write the column Jack Tinker's Last Night's First Night.
Yes, that's right.
And so he'd always run out of the show in the interval.
It would only get into the last edition, wouldn't it?
That's it. But he'd file the copy live down the phone from the lobby of the theatre.
Yeah.
No notes, nothing prepared. He'd do it all off the top of his head.
Yeah.
And he took me out every night for about 3 weeks.
Yes.
And my job was to just stand there and listen.
Or go and get the phone ready for him.
Just stand there and listen to how he did it. That's how I learned how to file copy.
Yeah, I see.
And Linda Lee Potter, similarly. I went out on several interviews with her and learned the technique, the tactics, the little tricks that she would use to get people to tell her things.
Yes.
And to this day, I use them.
Right.
People are always telling me things they really shouldn't.
Really, yeah.
And I learned all that at Linda's 30 Denier Knee.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. Well, you talk about Linda Lee Potter. I worked with the woman who was her nemesis, Jean Rook.
Oh, yeah.
And again, talking about...
Rook by nature.
Oh, yeah, Rook by nature. But Jean was incredibly the queen bee at the Daily Express. I think much more so than Linda Lee Potter was at the Mail, because the editor then was David...
English,
thank you. And David English wouldn't have allowed Linda Lee Potter to rise to the eminence that Jean Rook assumed on The Express, you know? And, like, for instance, on Diana's wedding day, I was working down there, but I'd been sent down from Manchester to bulk up the number of reporters on the streets, you know? I've got a great story, actually, about a bloke who came into town and made a fortune out of selling periscopes to the crowd.
Oh, great
who were three or four back.
Yeah.
And I saw all these periscopes, and I found him, and he'd come from Southend that day. He made £1,000 in those days.
Fortune.
By making these periscopes out of cardboard and mirrors for about, 50p or a pound, sell them for £5 to
people. We should do that, because there's always a crowd, isn't there? We should market that.
What, periscopes?
Yeah.
Yeah, well...
Up periscope.
Yeah, I'm amazed they haven't continued to do it. But anyway, point story is... what was I talking about? Oh, yeah, Gene Rook. So that day I went back into the building afterwards, everybody's together. I walked past Gene Rook's office, had a huge sign on it saying, no entry to anybody except editor, And that was because Jean had to get into her,
her zone.
Her zone, that's right, and type the magnificent piece on...
She was a weird woman, wasn't she?
Well...
I went on a job with her once.
Did you?
Yeah,
where?
Michael Jackson. They deployed her from the Express to come to Rome with us.
Yes.
The pack, the rock and roll pack.
Yeah.
To cover the first night of his European tour. It was May 1988.
Where was it?
The Flaminia Stadium. In Rome.
In Rome, right,
And she was a fish out of water because, we all thought she was so horribly old. She was probably only in her 40s or something.
Yeah, well, do you know what? Her skin wasn't very good
towards
the end.
But she didn't really try and mix with us. She kept herself to herself.
Yeah.
So we ridiculed her a bit. Yeah. And when she died, I felt really guilty about that.
Well, I'm afraid that's Fleet Street because the story of me and Gene Rook is that... So we had this experience. We were like the permanent crew in New York, and there were always firemen visiting, you know what I mean? Like a boxing writer for a big fight, Tyson or something like that. Or some guy who was coming through, maybe to cover a concert or something like that, Although I went to Canada and did Boy George's first concert, I think I've told you. But no, Gene was coming, and it was Gene Rook Across America. It was the summer, it was quiet, there was nothing going on. Gene Rook, and she still kept her Yorkshire accent. So she rang me from London and said, Gene here. Yeah, hi, Jean, and I'd hardly ever...
Hi, Jean, very good.
Yeah. I'd hardly ever met her. And she says, no, I'm fucking coming over, and you get me some fucking stories lined up, will you? What about the First Lady? And Reagan was in power at the time, so it was...
Didn't even get her own stories.
No, seriously. Yeah. Well,
imagine us getting away with that.
Yeah.
Oh, my word.
I said, the First Lady, I said, you're talking about Nancy Reagan? Yeah, you fucking tell her, it's Gene Rook,
She's going to know.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I thought, oh, well, that'll solve it all, I'll get a flight to Washington, it's only an hour, go up the White House, knock on the door. Oh, Nancy, do us a favour, will you? Gene Rook's coming over next week, will you be around for, a glass of champagne? It was ludicrous, And my response to that always was, you thought this, you didn't say it. It said, Gene, I work over here permanently 24 hours a day. If I could get Nancy Reagan, exactly, I'd be writing it, not you. What do you think I am? But anyway, so she came over and eventually we fixed her up with some people and she ended it in the Essex House Hotel, in Central Park South. I love that hotel, by the way.
It's very cool.
And so she did a bit and I think Ken Lennox had come with her, the photographer, photographer Ken, and so we're in the we're in Costello's, the bar, a copy's gone and all that kind of stuff, and there were no mobile phones in those days, so we relied on the phone in the corner ringing if anything happened. It rang one night for somebody to tell us that John Lennon had been shot, It was amazing, and. And anyway, the barman comes over, Freddie, and says, Gene Rook. And she said, yes, that's me. You got a call from London. It's your office. Oh, right. And she knew what it was about. It was the Herograms. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She was waiting for the editor to ring and say, so...
marvellous copy, darling.
Exactly.
It wasn't even ever that good. Sorry, Gene. God rest your soul. But it was so horribly alliterative.
Yeah.
And predictable, I thought. It was a bit Enid Blyton.
Well... Maybe, but I mean, obviously, she was a legend. But anyway, so she's in the phone booth, and she didn't close the door
because we all
closed the door because in those days it was all secret. You were talking to your desk and all that kind of stuff. She said, "Oh, is that all? Well, I don't understand what's gone wrong." And what had happened was the editor had said to her something like. And I think the editor was Larry Lamb, by the way, who was another Yorkshireman.
My name's Larry Lamb. Could I tell you, Mr. Farley, I run this fucking paper like I'd run an army unit when I tell you.
He was
you.
A character,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was always pissed. Larry was always pissed.
Yeah.
But anyway, what happened is, Larry said, Jane, wonderful bit of copy, Jane. I would say that copy, magnificent. To tell Kenny Lennox, brilliant pictures. And apparently, whoever rang her on previous foreign visits had always called the copy brilliant and the pictures magnificent, and Larry'd got it the wrong way round. It was the first time she'd worked for Larry. And she was crestfallen. I mean, absolutely crestfallen, you know. And in the end, we had to ring London to tell her how crestfallen Jean was, and I had to ring back and reverse the order of the compliments. That's how she was.
Oh, dear. But it's so insecure, isn't it?
Very insecure. A sad ending, because I was the news editor, and when we moved into our new building on Blackfriars Bridge, Jean had a big office up the other end, and she'd become a bit of a lonely character because a lot of new blood had come into the paper with the new building. So she'd come to me and say, you know, she hadn't any ideas for a column this week, you know, could I help her out? And I became quite friendly with her. You know, I'd say, why don't you try this? And, oh, that's good. And
well,
all
you were sapiosexual by any
chance? I was a sapiosexual, that's right, yeah. And I'd sit in her office, you know, and we'd have a... She had a fridge, not many people did, with booze in it, you know. And I'd have a few drinks and say, well, try this. Try. Oh, thanks. Oh, thank you, Michael. Thank you, Michael, and all that. So she then, unfortunately, was diagnosed with cancer. Goes into the home, and it happened very suddenly. I was there one day, and Nick, who was the editor, Sir Nicholas Lloyd, came down and said, OK, Mike. Nick normally shot out at lunchtime to go and play nine holes of golf. Nick was bone idle as an editor. Great guy, but never felt under pressure with Nick because he was such a nice guy. And he would normally nip out with Kelvin's brother, Craig, and they'd go and play nine holes at Dulwich or something like that, you know. Anyway, I said, OK, off to the, you know. He said, no, I'm not, actually. He said, we're going to see Jean. I said, oh, OK. She was in a private hospital in near where she lived in Kent.
Mm-hmm.
And he was halfway to the hospital, and I got a phone call on the desk. She died, just like that, sadly. She just died. And do you know the funny thing is, just before she died, she sat up rigidly in bed after having been, like, in a sort of coma or slumbering, asked for a drink. And she had a glass of sherry. And then she died.
Way to go.
Yeah, I know. What a way to go.
God rest her soul.
God rest her soul. Anyway, a bit of Fleet Street frolics there, Leslie Ann. I suppose we could sit here all day and talk about experiences in Fleet Street with the characters in Fleet Street that we've come across over the years. But once again, thank you very much indeed for joining me. And everybody out there, thank you very much indeed for listening. You've been listening to Planet Porky, the podcast with myself, with Leslie Ann Jones. And we will be back with you very soon indeed. Claudia Connell's not a nutter, that's for sure, because she's held down a job in Fleet Street for two or three decades, OK? I know there's a general perception in certain areas of society that journalists make things up. I don't think we do. I don't think we do. Most everything I've ever read in a newspaper has had a basis in fact. Certainly, there have been areas where facts have been built upon. Certainly, there have been areas where there have been economies with the truth, but there's always been a germ of fact there
so
for me.
So I'm not saying that she's made this up.
Yeah.
I'm saying that she is observing things that are happening in her home that have disturbed her, and that she's gone looking for help, and that this woman has seen her coming. But in Barbarella, famously had an orgasm through the palm of her hand.
That's
Do you remember
right.
that?
Didn't they take pills?
That makes your hair stand on end, doesn't it?
It makes your hair stand on end, but also, didn't they have sex by just taking a pill?
Oh, it makes sex so quick and easy. Who wants sex to be quick and easy?
Absolutely.
Guys?
And didn't they shout down from the clouds, Barbarella? Because she dressed in that, you know, very sexy sort of outfit and all that.
Bet she never had her ley lines red.
No, I bet she never had her ley lines red, no.
Do you believe in ley lines?
Ley lines. Is that all to do with Feng Shui?
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.